This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Since last December, Ukrainian protesters have been in the streets of Kiev, demonstrating against their government's refusal to sign an economic agreement with the European Union. The protests have been mostly peaceful up until Sunday. There are conflicting reports of how many people have died in clashes between protesters and riot police. Both sides are blaming each other. Opposition leaders did meet with President Viktor Yanukovych last night and gave him an ultimatum to call for early elections or face even more unrest. Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy has been one of the leading U.S. voices in this conflict from the start. He's the chairman of the Senate's Subcommittee on European Affairs, and he met with Yanukovych and the opposition during a visit to Kiev last month. We talked to him by phone yesterday afternoon. Senator Chris Murphy, welcome back to Where We Live.
Good to be with you.
So you and Senator McCain have released a statement about the passage of anti-protest laws by the Ukrainian parliament, controlled by President Yanukovych. Maybe you can explain what you and Senator McCain are hoping to do and what this statement says.
Well, things have clearly taken a turn for the worse in Kiev and across the Ukraine. President Yanukovych, I think, has decided to essentially try to end these protests with anti-democratic laws that lock up protesters and also now with violence on the square. These are things that we warned him would have repercussions from the United States. We have already started to revoke the visas of certain high-ranking Ukrainian officials, and our hope is that at some point he gets the message that the only way to solve this crisis is through talks with the opposition and perhaps recommitting himself to joining the European Union as the protesters have demanded.
What real effect do you think that some of these pressures will have? It seems as though for all of the talk about this, the ability of the United States to truly pressure President Yanukovych has been somewhat limited. I mean, what do you hope to accomplish here?
Well, ultimately, the pressure from the United States or from European countries is just going to be complementary to the real pressure, which is from the Ukrainian people. Right now, President Yanukovych cannot get elected again in a fair election in 2015. And so he is in the midst right now of attempting to solidify his power through illegal means. He is either going to be forced from power through a violent revolution. We hope to God that that is not the path. He is going to lose an election in 2015. The U.S. pressure is just going to essentially add on top of the pressure that he's feeling from millions of Ukrainians who don't want the kind of over-the-top leadership that comes occasionally now with violence from the Yanukovych administration.
We're talking with Senator Chris Murphy, who's traveled to Ukraine recently with Senator John McCain. But before we get a little bit more into some of the Russian involvement in this, maybe you can talk about that trip. I haven't really gotten a chance to talk with you about that. Who was it you met with? What is it you said to the Ukrainian people when you and Senator McCain went over there?
Well, we were there at the height of the early protests on the Maidan, which is the square in Kiev, and we spoke to the protesters, which that day were about 500,000 strong, and we said to them that the United States stands with them, and we aren't going to condone the kind of violence that we had seen in days earlier on the square, and that we would take actions to try to crack down on people who ordered those violent reactions. And then we met with President Yanukovych and his top people and said that if he chooses a different path, if he chooses to join the European Union, then the United States will stand with them and help them get their economy back on firm footing, help them deal with the inevitable reaction from the Russians, who could do pretty dramatic things to the Ukrainian people, like cutting off gas supplies for the winter. So our message was not different to the protesters and to Yanukovych. It was that if they make the choice to turn to Europe, if he commits himself to a nonviolent democracy that is Yanukovych, the United States will be with them and help them try to rebuild their economy, which has been pretty damaged over the last few years.
Now, I know that there are a number of people who are leading this protest, including a former heavyweight champ. Did you get a chance to talk with some of the leadership of the folks who are protesting in Kiev? Do you hope to make more contact with those folks in the future? And do you think that there's some sort of a chance that out of this conflict will come some new leadership, some new people rising from the grassroots in Ukraine?
Well, I think we're very hopeful of that. Senator McCain and I met with the opposition leadership in Kiev, which, as you mentioned, includes Vitaly Klitschko, a former heavyweight champion. I have kept in touch with the political leadership. I actually met with some of their representatives in Washington about a week ago. And they are united in the sense that they are going to stand with the protesters in a nonviolent way to try to recommit the country to European integration and to try to root out a lot of the corruption that's happening within the Yanukovych administration. The funny thing, though, is, John, that the protesters are really not that political. I mean, the protesters are not down there because they want to replace Yanukovych with Klitschko. The protesters are down there because they're sick of seeing a government that too often resorts to violence, that has become endemic with corruption and is moving towards Russia instead of towards the European Union. So the protesters don't necessarily just want a political solution. They want their government to clean their act up, and hopefully Klitschko and his group are committed to delivering on that should they sooner or later take the reins of power.
Well, and of course, Russia is a big part of this. Let's talk about that, because conversations have been had recently between President Obama and President Putin in Russia. But those conversations had to do, as far as we know, with ongoing peace talks in Syria. The fact is that the Russians have long backed the Syrian regime there. So this is one very important international issue that the United States is engaged with in Russia. The second is, of course, the upcoming Sochi Olympics, where having seen some recent violence in Russian cities, there are fears for not only U.S. athletes, but other athletes when it comes to terrorism potentially around those games. Do you fear that the plight of the Ukrainians may be lost, Senator, in all of this other talk that has to do with Russia and these other very important issues?
Yeah, I mean, we perhaps have no more complicated relationship in the world than we do with Russia. And you mentioned, you know, three very important issues that we have with them. But of course, we're also working with them to end Iran's nuclear ambitions. We're working with them on bigger counterterrorism issues. We're partners in Afghanistan as we wind down our obligations there. So this thing is as big and as messy a relationship as we get. Ultimately, I think we have to understand that Russia's stakes in the future of Ukraine are greater than the United States' stakes are there. It's Russia's neighboring country. It's the biggest of the former republics, and Russia is going to exert more energy and be willing to spend more money to try to keep Ukraine in its orbit than the United States is going to be able to spend and exert to try to move them towards Europe. And we just have to admit that there is an imbalance of priority between the U.S. and Russia, but it should be at the top of our list. Ukraine is a country of around 40 million people, and it represents a big market to the United States and to Europe, and a big win for democracy should it turn away from the clutches of Mother Russia.
Last thing for you, Senator, before I let you go, and you just mentioned one of these other issues that we had not brought up, the fact that the United States is engaging with Russia and so many other countries around the world in trying to get Iran to give up its nuclear ambitions. I know that you have split with your colleague in the Senate, Senator Richard Blumenthal, on whether or not we should extend sanctions against Iran. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about how you feel the United States should move forward when it comes to sanctions against Iran either being lessened as we talk about their nuclear ambitions or strengthened, as Senator Blumenthal has said. And maybe you can talk a little bit about any conversations you've had with Senator Blumenthal.
Well, you know, the difference between those of us who are on the different sides of the sanctions issue is really just one of strategy. I think that if these negotiations with Iran fall through, then we should immediately impose tough, new, crippling sanctions. The difference that I have with Senator Menendez and others who are pushing this new sanctions bill is that I don't think that we should pass the bill today, because I think that really threatens to unwind these negotiations. The whole reason that we put these sanctions in place over the last 5 years is so that we could get the Iranians to the negotiating table. Now, having gotten there, why on earth would we show a message of insincerity by putting a new round of sanctions on them just when we're starting to talk? The difference between Senator Blumenthal and I don't think is big at all. I think what Senator Blumenthal has said is that he is a co-sponsor of that resolution, but actually doesn't think that it should come before the Senate for a vote at the present time. I'm not a co-sponsor of it, but My main belief is that ultimately we should reserve the discussion for sanctions until after the negotiations are done. I think it's less than a 50-50 shot that we can get a deal. I'm not sure that the Iranians are sincere, but this is our last best shot to do this through diplomatic means, and we shouldn't screw it up with a debate in the Senate over sanctions that is going to give a reason for the hardliners in Iran to push their negotiators away from the table.
Senator Chris Murphy talking about Iran and also Ukraine. Thank you so much for joining us, Senator. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, John.
Coming up next, we'll discuss last week's ruling against the FCC on the issue of net neutrality. We'll be joined by CT Tech Junkies Lon Seidman and the president of a technology think tank in Washington. You can join the conversation. Are you worried about the future of the World Wide Web? Are you concerned about net neutrality? Call us at 860-275-7266. Email wherelive at WNPR.org. Or you can tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll talk with WNPR's Diane Orson about a local man who was one of hundreds of children rescued from the Nazis before World War II. But first, last week, a federal court ruling has renewed the debate over net neutrality. The FCC lost the case to enforce its open Internet order, but some argue that the agency is strengthened by this decision. If you've been following the net neutrality debate, we want to hear from you. What concerns do you have? What implications might a less neutral Internet have on you? 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. If you want to join this conversation, email us wherelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherelive. And I know a lot of you have been tweeting us over the course of this last week or so to try to get us to talk a bit more about this. So we are with Lon Seidman, co-founder of the Independent Media Network and writer for CTTechJunkie.com. Good to see you once again, Lon.
Good to be here.
Also joining us by phone is Baron Soka, who's president of Tech Freedom. It's a D.C. think tank on technology issues. Baron, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lon, first of all, lay this out for us. And this is one of those stories where it seems as though the first paragraph of every print article or the first few minutes of every radio story has to really be explaining what we're talking about when right. we say net neutrality. So I'll give you the floor, Lon.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'll do my best here. So really what it comes down to is how do you treat packets on the network, which is the network being the Internet. So the big issue, I think, for a lot of carriers has been that you've had these huge bandwidth consumers like Netflix demanding a significant portion of the United States bandwidth in an evening with everyone, you know, binging on House of Cards or something like that.
I read it as much as all the people in Ohio and New York put together or something like that. It's an awful lot of people watching Netflix at one time.
It is, exactly. Yep. So what the carriers are saying is, hey, look, this is costing us a lot of money because we have to maintain this infrastructure. We have to be able to supply our customers with enough bandwidth to support all of their viewing habits. And you know, their argument is, and to some degree they're correct, and some degree they're incorrect, that you know, Netflix is basically freeloading on their highway, and they want to be able to be compensated maybe by charging them more or something along those lines. And the argument from the other side comes from people like myself, who are independent content creators, who have discovered, you know, a wonderful way to, you know, allow people to empower themselves to launch their own publications, for example. And if the Internet becomes a toll road, the smaller folks in the space like myself and the people we help will be at a disadvantage. And it comes back to the culture of the Internet, which was really founded around a hacker ethos of information should be free and treated equally. But we're getting into a dangerous territory where things are becoming a little less equal depending on how much money you have. And I think that kind of is the center of the argument right now. And it's very complex because this is not like a public network like the phone network was, per se, or certainly the way the public airwaves are. It is something that's controlled by a number of companies around the world. It's very hard to you know, have local laws impact how this network operates. And it's going to be a really complex issue moving forward. And my fear is that now that the court has made its decision the way it has, that people are going to really test the waters, see how far they can go with consumers before they push back, or, you know, see how far regulators will go before they try to figure out a different way to regulate it.
But before we talk about some of the implications perhaps moving forward and what the FCC may or may not do, let's talk a little bit more about what this highway really is and who exactly is supposed to own it. So, Baron Soka, there's two contrasting ideas here. One that Lon points out is that these Internet providers have a highway that you maybe should have to pay to get on, Netflix, for instance, using an awful lot of bandwidth. And there's the other argument that, indeed, this is a public highway. Let's go through the argument for each. I mean, why is it, Baron, that we should assume that this is something that is free and open to all?
Well, I would leave Lon to make that argument. I think Netflix is a pretty good example. And if you want to look at how Netflix feels, they put out a statement this morning in a letter to their investors saying that they're not terribly worried. They think that ISPs aren't going to discriminate against them because there is a broad support, as they say, for net neutrality in principle, and ISPs don't want to galvanize government action. I think that's exactly right. That's why you haven't seen the sorts of doom and gloom scenarios that that many people have worried about, and why the FCC really had only four small incidents that even those were overblown to point to in justifying the need for regulation. So those of us who have been skeptical of the FCC here are not saying that there couldn't ever hypothetically be a problem, but that there hasn't been thus far. And that if there were, if you actually saw the scenario that most people are afraid of, where a cable company discriminates against net neutrality because it's against Netflix because Netflix is a direct competitor, that's why we have antitrust laws. There are already laws on the books that deal with anti-competitive behavior. So I don't find it surprising that at the end of the day, Netflix actually isn't as worried as most people think maybe that they should be. And at the same time, I think, as we can talk about this, the FCC didn't really lose this case. All they lost was the two particular rules that they tried to put in place. The court made it very clear that they can still do a lot to regulate net neutrality and many other things besides.
Lon, if we could just for a moment get back to my larger philosophical point, which is just maybe we can make both cases here. I want to understand a little bit better for our listeners, for our conversation here, why we should assume that this public sphere is open and it's not something that an internet service provider should be able to say, we're going to clamp down or we're going to restrict access to this highway.
Right, and that's the challenge, because really it's I think in my mind it's very philosophical that it should be this way, that you know the many great things that the internet has brought to society, and it's certainly arguably brought some not so good things to society, has been there because everyone has been able to have a voice on there, and to some degree it's very democratic, because the more people who follow what you have to say, whether it's through a social network or through something you're doing on your own, you know, the greater your ability to amplify your voice. And when you start to put in controls on that, when you start to make it more difficult for someone who just on their own wants to go do something, it becomes very difficult. I think the big thing, especially for independent creators, is that the internet took away the scarcity of distribution that largely built the mass media industry. It wasn't easy to make a newspaper. It wasn't easy to do a radio show. But you can literally, I do this, sit in my basement and make YouTube videos and pay the grocery bill now. And it's a pretty empowering thing. But, you know, I'm not making enough to pay an ISP $1 million a year to have a better spot on their network. The other problem you run into is that in many cases, the places where we are communicating are not public spaces. They're not the public square. So, for example, with YouTube, I'm not protected necessarily by the Constitution there. I am, you know, basically having to comply with Google's terms of service for how I use YouTube.
It's the YouTube Constitution.
Exactly. And in fact, in many areas, especially related to copyright law and interpretation of fair use, you're not even protected by federal laws that were designed to protect content creators. You know, you're subject to YouTube's terms and services, but they deem that you're violating copyright. Video game creators are taking content creators, people that do make videos about video games. I wish I had started earlier. I could be playing video games for a living. But they're making a lot of money. But YouTube started to crack down on the use of video game imagery and music because some people were making issues about it. And suddenly people lost a lot of revenue. And just because they made that determination according to their terms of service. So it's difficult. You can go out and host your own stuff. It costs a little bit more, and a lot of people do. Glenn Beck is a great example. He's making about $40 or $50 million a year doing things on his own. But what happens if suddenly Glenn Beck can't afford to pay the carrier to be able to be treated equally as other content providers are, and he may have the better ability to do that. But nevertheless, you're in this situation where, you know, the philosophy is beginning to erode, and the question is whether or not a government regulation should be put into place to make this the rule as to how this network operates.
So, and we'll get to the government regulation piece of this in a moment, but Baron Soka, maybe you can talk through the impact on the little guy that Lon Seidman is representing here. Throughout this argument, we've been hearing that Netflix is the number one provider of a service that millions and millions of Americans want, that may be slowed or in some ways impinged by this ruling. You say not to worry about that. What about guys like Lon, who make videos in his basement and make money off them?
Well, I frankly think Lon has it exactly backwards, and almost everybody does. So, first of all, Lon's right that what we're talking about here really is video, because the issue is not, frankly, that cable company or your internet provider is going to degrade a particular source of content, but rather that some sources of content want to be able to strike deals. That is, video platforms like a Netflix or a YouTube, they want to strike deals to make sure that when they're streaming video, they can stream very high-quality video that right now, frankly, is very difficult.
And by the way, speaking of high-quality video and or audio, Baron, what we're going to do is we're going to drop your line quickly, and we're going to try to reestablish because we're having a little bit difficulty hearing you. If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. If you have concerns about this ruling, about net neutrality, what it might mean for you, creative use of the internet, you can email us where we live at WNPR.org. Or you can join the conversation by tweeting us at where we live. Sometimes, as we see, Lon, even the old-fashioned technology like cell phones or landlines can fail us. So when it gets to what the FCC is going to do right now, one of the arguments that that Baron Silke and others make is, okay, this hands over an opportunity for the FCC now to reestablish new rules. There are some people say, well, that's good. They can write brand new rules that open up this internet to all and make things just shiny and rosy. And then others say, well, but it's the FCC. We should be very scared about the government having this kind of control.
And that's funny. It's a point. It's actually a good point and a funny point, because for a lot of internet people, we're concerned about regulation coming into the internet space. It has been largely unregulated. As our guest alluded to, the fact there are laws that kind of impact the internet, like the FTC's rules on product endorsements. And we had that show a few months ago. We talked about that. But basically, you know, it's been a very unregulated space, and it's mainly because people wanted to see what happens. So we don't tax the internet like we tax other things, and we're starting to see sales tax work its way into there. But we don't require a license to broadcast like you would need for to own the public or use part of the public airwaves. So, you know, we're seeing very very cautious approaches here, with people saying we need net neutrality, but don't go too far on the regulatory front, because it might impact our ability to see how this whole internet plays out. And the new FCC chairman has kind of alluded to the fact that, you know what, maybe we should see how the market plays with this notion of neutrality. And it just gets very dangerous, because my fear is that generally consumers don't care as much about this issue as maybe content creators do, especially independent creators. I think if their Netflix traffic became impinged, they would certainly raise an issue.
Going beyond Netflix, make the case for why the consumer, not the little guy like you, making stuff and making some money off the internet, but just me wanting to, you know, find stuff on the internet, whether it's video or audio or free speech, anything. What might be the biggest impact, negative impact, that you're worried about, Lon?
I would say more on society maybe than the average consumer, in that if, you know, for some reason Google decides certain speech is no longer acceptable on their network and they're the ones paying the bill for this good video streaming quality, if they decide suddenly that, you know what, certain types of political speech aren't going to be acceptable here, we're going to kick you off because you're not right. We're seeing it on Facebook all the time when, you know, I think there was a controversy over that the fact that Facebook was not allowing pictures of breastfeeding, as an example, right? There was this whole big debate over what was acceptable use or not. It was up to Facebook to decide. It wasn't a constitutional right that was being violated necessarily because of that issue. So my concern is that, you know, these players that do have the money to get a better spot on the network could very well decide that certain forms of speech that might be offensive to some, you know, just shouldn't be allowed at all. And, is it bad that we maybe lose offensive speech on Facebook? Who knows? But it's bad that if any kind of speech is being restricted in some way, it can create problems for society. I think we've been very strong as a society because we don't restrict any speech. You're responsible for what you say. And I think that would still certainly continue. And we've seen examples of that on the internet when people make some real offensive comment on Twitter, whether it's something, you know, crazy like some pop culture thing or something more serious. You know, the internet responds to that. People have a public opinion that they raise. So, you know, my concern moving forward is just that, we're basically being regulated and judged by the terms of service of a carrier who might have the ability to project our voice better than we could on our own.
We're talking with Lon Seidman, who's co-founder of the Independent Media Network, and he's a writer for CTTechJunkie.com. He joins us fairly regularly to talk about issues like this. And we're talking about net neutrality in the program today, 860-275-7266. If you want to join us, and we're going to get to some of your phone calls in a moment, Baron Soka joins us from Tech Freedom, a D.C. think tank on technology issues. We actually lost his phone line for a moment, and I think Baron's back. And I wanted you to weigh in on the big issue that you have here. If indeed what has essentially happened is the FCC now gets a chance to rewrite the rules, you have concerns about the FCC authority over this. Explain a bit, Baron.
Well, what the court said here, again, was that the particular rules that the FCC wrote went too far. But the court affirmed that, in general, the FCC can do a lot, and they don't even need to write rules. They could move forward on a case-by-case basis without any clear limiting principles and simply decide what's neutral and what's not. But they can do that not just for broadband providers. They can regulate now any internet company that's within their jurisdiction as long as they can somehow claim that their regulation will help broadband. And in the past, they've upset a lot of the very net neutrality advocates that have been lobbying them to regulate by using that kind of authority to, for example, require copyright enforcement. So I'm very concerned now that the very people who for many years have been telling us that net neutrality is just about limiting broadband providers have now unleashed a regulatory monster that could regulate the very sorts of content providers and other companies that they think shouldn't be regulated.
I want to go to the phones here. Chris is calling from West Hartford. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, John. Great show. Interesting topic. The question I have is there anything that would prevent your bandwidth providers, your Comcast, your AT&T, cable internet companies, from doing the same thing that cell phone companies have taken to doing, which is to limit your data usage and then charge you incrementally for your data usage, so that if you're the individual consumer watching Netflix a lot, well, you've just got to pay more for the bandwidth that you use. And then that way you could keep the net neutrality rules in place so that you don't have this free rider problem so much necessarily.
Chris, thank you for the question. Baron, what do you think?
Well, so the answer is right now the wired broadband companies do have a tiered data plan. So on Comcast, that's a 300 gigabyte plan. And that's upset many net neutrality advocates who think that that somehow hurts alternative video sources like Netflix. I think that's kind of silly because that 300 gigabytes a month turns out to be, I did the math on this, that's something like 8 to 10 hours of video a day that you'd have to watch. So number one, if that threshold were lower, maybe there would be a concern that it's anti-competitive, but it's set really high. And number two, the people who want to regulate those sorts of tiered pricing plans, what they would really end up doing, frankly, is forcing average consumers to pay more because a very tiny percentage of users pays a lot. But this is your question is, I think, a really good one, because this is where the dispute's really going. In the wireless context, just before the D.C. Circuit decision, AT&T announced what they're calling a sponsored data program that would let video providers sponsor or subsidize the data that their mobile users use, so that it wouldn't be counted against the much, much lower data tiers, like 2, 4, 6, 8 gigabytes a month on a wireless plan. And so some people are now alleging that that's a net neutrality violation. This is exactly the kind of thing that I think the court's saying here, that the FCC needs to leave some flexibility for, so that you could have situations where ESPN is the company that maybe talked about this last year. ESPN could strike a deal with a wireless provider to figure out better ways of providing video over the network. I think that's a pro-consumer innovation. That's the sort of thing that Lon seems to be worried about. I don't think we should be. I think the FCC has plenty of power now to ensure that sort of deal isn't used to hurt competitors and make sure that it could be used to find new ways to do video better over especially wireless networks.
And what you're talking about here is letting things play out, but then really being able to go after true anti-competitive behavior. Do you feel confident, Baron, that the government will be able to regulate in this world true anti-competitive behavior. We seem to have fallen down somewhat in some other parts of the market. We're not always very good about making sure that we don't have monopolies that that have undue influence. Do you think that that's going to work in this particular instance?
Well, sure. Number one, the antitrust laws have always applied here, and they always have played a role. And I think perhaps part of the reason that Comcast set their initial data tier at 300 gigabytes instead of, say, 50 gigabytes is the antitrust laws. And number two, the FCC, after this decision, has, again, quite broad authority to require that, for example, any deal struck be the terms be reasonable and non-discriminatory, which is to say that they can go a lot farther than the antitrust law could. So I think even if you worried about those things, the government has plenty of power. But there's also not any evidence that there are going to be anti-competitive deals here. And I would point you again to Netflix saying today that they themselves are not that concerned. And to what Lon was saying before I got dropped, I think Lon's concerns really, it sounds like, aren't so much with the broadband providers, but with video platform operators like YouTube. And the reality is that it's just not realistic that every guy and his brother is going to set up an independent video distribution platform. They're going to use the YouTubes of the world and the Vimeos and the Hulus and the Netflix. And so as long as those companies are able to negotiate for reasonable deals with broadband providers to make sure that you could get especially fast streaming, that's the world that the D.C. Circuit's now opened us up to. That's the supposed non-neutrality that everyone's so afraid of. I don't think that's such a bad thing, especially for small providers who are able to put their content up on an open platform like YouTube. That's what I meant when I said that I think the net neutrality advocates have this backwards, that giving those small operators the ability to make sure that their content gets really good carriage, gets really good speeds on a YouTube or a Hulu, that can actually be good for the small providers and help them compete against the well-established big companies that already have what are called content delivery networks. They can already evade the neutral net in favor of something that is very not neutral, and I don't think that's bad.
Lon?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in the case of someone who's doing non-controversial content or something that fits within the terms of service of those companies, it's fine. You know, it's not that someone couldn't go out and roll their own video streaming. It's certainly not as easy as it would be otherwise. But if you look also at people doing podcasting, which is largely a self-hosted kind of endeavor where you're putting an audio file out and having somebody download that, you know, I think the fear that I have, and I'm not as crazed about this as others might be at the moment, but it's just that you can do these things on your own, and that data is treated the same. It may not be as easy as it would be to go to YouTube at the moment, but there are many people in this space struggling to be able to earn enough revenue by running their own ads or doing whatever that a lot of the terms of service of those organizations might prevent. I had an issue when I was doing a new startup in West Hartford. We were doing video news. We got kicked off of one of these video providers, not because of our content, but because we were intending to take advertising and ask them how to do it. They didn't even respond. They just kicked us off. So, you know, you're subject to a lot of these kinds of issues. And, you know, at the end of the day, if I, a self-hosted video provider, a self-hosting podcaster, am treated differently, that is a concern. May not happen, but it could. And I think that's where the issue lies. And I think that's really where the debate is where will this go? How far will it be allowed to go?
In just the last couple of minutes we have, Lon, where would you like to see it go? I mean, if you had a chance to map something out that's going to make sense for consumers and is also realistic in the marketplace that we're talking about here, where would you head it?
I think really just continuing the notion of treating all of the data the same, that someone is not going to get a better amount of bandwidth. I mean, I think there's certainly an argument on the bandwidth restrictions. I think that it's something realistic that, you know, if I'm downloading movies all day illegally, that's impacting other customers' experience of that. And I certainly agree with looking at that issue moving forward. But I think that we just need to treat the data streaming over the network the same. And that's where my concern is, that if I'm treated differently because I don't have as much money as some of these larger players do, That's a problem to me.
And I think part of what Barron's saying is there's no sense right now that that's going to happen. You're worried about a slippery slope here, but there's no sense necessarily that that is coming down the pike right now.
It may not happen right now, and I think Netflix would certainly rally up all, you know, have the bazillion customers they have to contest this, of course. It would, I think we'd have a SOPA-level kind of fight over it. But without, you know, some agreement as to those things moving forward, I think ultimately companies that provide internet to homes have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders that if somebody comes up with a business proposal that makes sense for them, of course they're going to have to go. They have a responsibility to their shareholders to do that. And I think having the ability to make sure that we're not drowning out the other voices that can't afford that same level of service, irrespective of whether they choose to go on one of these providers or not. I mean, I think the choice needs to be there for creators.
Barron, but in the last couple of minutes we have, where would you like to see this go? If you could put a roadmap for where this heads next.
Well, the net already isn't neutral. There are already content delivery platforms that advantage big video distributors. So Lon's concern, I think, is really more with the existing video distribution landscape than with broadband providers. I don't think it's really a net neutrality concern. So I think the concerns here are either misdirected or largely hypothetical. And in the name of dealing with those, what we really just did is give the FCC the discretion to regulate the internet more generally. This is the story nobody's talking about. They're so focused on net neutrality and on broadband that they're not paying attention to the fact that even though the courts said the two rules that the FCC tried to propose went too far, that the FCC can do a lot on broadband and net neutrality generally, but also on any internet company so long as the FCC makes some argument, no matter how cockamamie, that regulation somehow helps broadband, they're going to be able to get away with that. And again, that's going to affect a lot of the concerns that people have about copyright enforcement. It could be any number of other things that now three unelected bureaucrats at the Federal Communications Commission can now regulate. So I find it really quite sadly ironic that the slippery slope here is quite real. And it's been brought to us by people who say that they're concerned about broadband, but really have just given the FCC an enormous tool to regulate the internet.
Barron Soka is president of Tech Freedom, a D.C. think tank on technology issues. If you're on our Twitter feed at Where We Live, you can read his story for Wired about this. Barron, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Lon Seidman. He's co-founder of the Independent Media Network and writer for CTTechJunkie.com. You can check out all sorts of stuff about not only gizmos, but also about the net more broadly. Lon, always good to see you. Thank you so much.
Good to be here again. Thank you.
And, of course, you can continue this conversation online at WNPR.org. Coming up, we'll talk with WNPR's Diane Orson about a local man who was one of hundreds of children rescued from the Nazis before World War II. It's an amazing story that comes your way next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, the word genius was once reserved to describe great thinkers like Leonardo da Vinci and Albert Einstein. Today, you can meet swarms of so-called geniuses just by going to your local Apple store. On our next program, we're asking, what does it really mean to be a genius? We'll also talk to Doug Stone about his new book, Einstein and the Quantum. Please join us on the next Where We Live. Now, next Monday marks the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Here in Woodbridge, Connecticut, there's a screening of a film called Nikki's Family. It's a Czech documentary that tells the nearly forgotten story of Nicholas Winton, a British stockbroker, who organized the rescue of 669 children just before the start of World War II. WNPR's managing editor Diane Orson is here to talk about the film and about someone here in Connecticut whose life was saved by Winton. Diane, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, John.
So give us a brief outline of this story.
Well, Nikki's Family uses newsreel footage and interviews and dramatic reenactments to tell the story of Nicholas Winton, who organized what are known as the Kinder Transports. These were trains full of children that he helped leave from Prague, and most of these children went to England, some went to Sweden. It's remarkable because he had to find families for each child, match each child with a family, plus be sure each child had a certain sum of money in order for them to enter the country. And he managed to save nearly 700 children. Nicholas Winton is still alive. He's living in England, and he's 104 years old.
I have a motto that if something isn't blatantly impossible, there must be a way of doing it.
For more than 50 years, Nguyen Tin never told anyone, not even his wife, that he had done this. And in the late 1980s, she found a scrapbook in their attic that had photos of each child, the families who they were going to stay with, and transport plans for the children. So it's quite remarkable.
And you've actually talked to a Connecticut resident, one of the children who was saved by Nguyen Tin. These were kids at the time, elderly people now.
That's right. Ivan Backer is a Hartford resident. He's now 84 years old. He came into the studio to talk about his experience on the Kinder transports, and we're going to listen to a part of that conversation. He told me that life was really very happy and uneventful growing up in Prague until March 15, 1939, when German troops marched into the city.
I remember that day very vividly because I went to school, and on the main street of our neighborhood, I saw the troops riding in their motorcycles, often with a sidearm, and people on the streets crying. And I soon understood why they were, because our country had lost its freedom.
So about how old were you then?
I was 10 years old.
How did your parents arrange for you to become one of the children on the transport?
I'm not sure, and I've often wondered about that. My father left for London on a business trip the day before the Nazis occupied Czechoslovakia. My brother had already been accepted at a college in Margate, England. So that meant two of us were out. And at some point, my mother must have gotten to Nicholas Winton and arranged for me to be on the Kinder transport.
Do you have memories of the trip?
I remember the train went north from Prague and then through Germany all night. And I vividly remember that I felt, here I am in the heart of my enemy's country. And it was not exactly fear, but it was an awareness that there was danger lurking all around. But on the trip as a whole, I just thought it was a great adventure to go on a train and go to a new country, just like a 10-year-old kid would, I think.
When you were growing up, were you aware of the role that Sir Nicholas Winton had played in your leaving Czechoslovakia?
I had no knowledge of it at all. Of course, he never told anybody, as you may know from the film, until 1987, when his wife discovered this scrapbook in their attic and asked him what all this meant. Of course, since then, I've become intimately acquainted with the amazing story, how essentially a British well-to-do stockbroker playboy came to this awareness that there was nobody helping the children in Czechoslovakia to get out, and so he took it upon himself to do so.
Now that this film is being screened around the country and actually in other countries, what do you hope people will take away from it?
Mainly that one individual can make a difference. You know, we live in an age where so many of us feel helpless and you know, what can I as an individual do? Well, he was an individual. He had no organizational support, and yet he saved the lives of 669 children. It's amazing the energy that must have gone into that. He had to find British families to become sponsors. He had to deal with the Nazis, who were always wanting more money. But he persisted, and then his main regret was that the last transport, which was scheduled to leave on September 1st, the day the invasion of Poland began. And it was his biggest transport. It had 250 kids on it. Did not get out of Prague because war had just broken out. And some of us think that that may be the reason that he never spoke publicly about it, because he was so devastated that those 250 children never made it.
As you reflect from where you sit now back on your life, and now that this story has come out, is there anything else that you'd like to mention?
Two things. One thing that I was just tremendously lucky. I mean, I keep thinking I did nothing to deserve being saved, and if I hadn't left, the probability is that I would have perished at Auschwitz. The second thing is, I've written a poem.
Please.
I'd like to read. The title of the poem is Trains. Memories, distant yet fresh, of trains from Prague to visit grandparents and sled down long hills. Train from Czechoslovakia, longest and scariest, with other kinder transport young ones, through heart of Third Reich. Arrive Victoria Station, happy seeing my father, but foster family, Orthodox Jews, strange to me. War erupts, another train. London school children evacuated to Midlands for safety, a new family home. Attend two boarding schools, one Czech, the other English. Longer train rides ensue, bring sense of independence. Wartime voyage across Atlantic, convoys, zigzags, two perilous weeks, thrills me, exciting adventure. Land in Canada, overnight train to Montreal, enter United States, arrive Grand Central Station, discover world's largest city. Till now, each train met by someone, known or unfamiliar. Next train to college, no one waits, now completely on my own. The station in Pennsylvania recalls Victoria Station 5 years earlier, nervous and scared before seeing father and new family. Years later, the Shoah film, Holocaust victims sardined in cattle cars destined for gas chambers, recalled my escape. Trains brought death to some, for me life, safe from extinction. The question still haunts me. Why was I spared? No explanation. Blind chance or hidden design? No answer satisfies. I am forever grateful. I strive for life of purpose, struggle for social justice, answers my search for meaning, becomes my North Star.
That's Hartford resident Ivan Backer speaking with WNPR's Diane Orson. Ivan Backer was one of 669 children rescued from Czechoslovakia by Sir Nicholas Winton just before the start of World War II. The film Nicky's Family tells their story. It'll be screened at the JCC of Greater New Haven on Monday, which is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And Ivan Backer, who you just heard from, will also be there. Thanks to WNPR's Diane Orson for providing us with this story. It's fascinating. Thanks so much, Diane.
Thanks, John.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tilarsky. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.